Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Monday, January 1st, 2024. Happy New Year to all of our listeners. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockard and myself, Scott Splavik. And now here's Carol with our first story.
Thank you, Scott. Our first article is Scott County absorbs medic ambulance service as of today, January 1st. No loss of service for anybody. The nonprofit ambulance service, Medic EMS, will become part of Scott County government starting January 1st. If all goes smoothly, 911 callers won't notice any difference. For anyone expecting an ambulance, one will arrive, emphasized Paul Andorf, the director of Medic EMS of Scott County. It should be seamless, Andorf said. There's no loss of service for anybody. For years, medic and local government leaders have considered bringing the nonprofit emergency transportation service under the umbrella of a government entity to study the organization's finances as it faces higher costs and lower revenue. In 2022, Medic appealed to the county and cities to make ambulance service part of local government. County supervisors voted in April to absorb Medic, and in August hired Andorf, a 27-year Medic employee, to lead the new department. His predecessor, Linda Fredrickson, will retire with the transition. With the transition has come a lot of logistic planning. On January 1st, about 154 Medic employees and volunteers will become employees of or volunteers for the county, Andorf said. That will change employees' health care and retirement benefits. The number includes 26 volunteers, 16 dispatch employees, 53 paramedics, 36 EMTs, 5 people in the transportation division, and 10 administrative staff, Andorf said. 19 ambulance vehicles will transition too, he said. Medic's contracts with the area hospitals, nursing homes, and hospice centers for transports will also transition. The ambulance service contracts to transport patients to a destination, for example, delivering patients from a hospital to a nursing home. Medic covers some Muscatine territory, and that coverage will remain the same too, Andorf said. The supervisors have approved asset transitions, mutual aid agreements, and contracts in the past few months. Everything is status quo, Andorf said. And what is next? Once January 1st sails by, Andorf plans to set his sights on unlocking government funding for Medic. One such program is Ground Emergency Medical Transport Funding, authorized by the Iowa Legislature in 2018. The program is administered by the Iowa Health and Human Services Department. Publicly owned or operated ambulance services can get extra payments to help cover the gap between the cost to transport patients in emergencies and what they receive from Medicaid. Cost reports are due annually by the end of November, according to the state's website. As a county department, the ambulance agency can also use the Iowa Setoff Program to collect a portion of tax refunds and casino and lottery winnings from people who are delinquent on their ambulance bills, Andorf said. It's a program not available to nonprofits. Andorf said it helps offset those expenses. Those people are usually the ones we send to collections that don't want to pay the bill.
Thank you, Carol. Next, a legacy that lives on. Bettendorf woman recalls receiving donated pancreas encourages donation. It's written by Tom Lowy of the Quad City Times. The phone rang in Melissa Nelson's house at 10:20 p.m. April 24th, 2019. Caller identification showed it was from Madison, Wisconsin. She answered the call and her life changed. I'll never forget the time or the day. It's burned into my memory. That was the call from the transplant call center in Madison, said Nelson, who is 38 and lives in Bettendorf. I was shocked. I looked at the phone when it rang and saw where it was from, and I told myself that it couldn't be true. They wouldn't be calling so soon. Nelson had just gone active on the transplant list on April 22, 2024, roughly 36 hours before she got the call. She was eligible for a pancreas transplant because she had type 1 diabetes and her body could no longer show symptoms of when her blood sugar levels dipped dangerously low. From 2015 to 2019, Nelson got insulin from a pump and could live without the transplant, but was living with severe illness. A new pancreas would improve her health and make her diabetes free. As soon as I answered, the voice on the other end said, "We have a match for you," and this grief overcame me, Nelson said. I wasn't even thinking about me because I knew that if there was a match for me, some family somewhere was having the worst day of their lives. If there was a pancreas for me, that meant someone had died. I started crying hysterically. A 35-year-old person from Minnesota, a person who declared themselves an organ donor, had died. That person, Nelson said, left behind a legacy that she shares with anyone who asks. My family has been touched in so many ways by organ donors, she said. I will tell my story as many times as I can because it is so important. I will go anywhere I can to get the message out. Nelson and her family left earlier this week for Pasadena, California to be honored at the January 1st, 2024 One Legacy Donate Life Rose Parade float ahead of the Rose Bowl. Travel expenses for the families are paid for thanks to a donation to Iowa Donor Network from the Gurdon Family Foundation. The trip to Pasadena is very different from the one she made on April 25, 2019. It was hard to sleep that night after I got the call, and we left the next day for Madison, Nelson said. I was excited and nervous. My son Benjamin was little, and there's the worry about what will happen to you and your responsibilities to your child. But I think it really hit when we got to check in and I told them I was there for a transplant. Nelson's surgery, led by Dr. John Ordorico, took 6 hours. Ordorico is the surgical director of the University of Wisconsin's Pancreas and Islet Cell Transplant Program and a professor of surgery at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He said the program performs between 30 and 40 transplants per year. Ordorico said there are two basic types of pancreas transplants, transplants that replace a kidney or both kidneys at the same time, and transplants of the pancreas only. Nelson needed only a pancreas. Melissa's surgery went well, very well, Ordorico said. She was in very good shape, which always helps. She had taken very good care of herself, is very athletic, and that is always a help. Nelson is a lifelong runner and was a competitive athlete who graduated from Moline High School in 2003. She attended St. Ambrose University and was 22 years old when she was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. I had been obsessed with staying healthy, especially when I learned that a pancreas transplant would offer a life of being free of diabetes, Nelson said. So I was in the best shape I could be in. Jacob Nelson was at his wife's bedside when she woke up from the transplant. He held my hand and said, "You are diabetes free now." It was an amazing feeling, Melissa Nelson said. While the surgery went well, Nelson's recovery did not. She developed blood clots 2 days after the surgery and ended up spending 2 weeks in the hospital. I was given a 2% chance of keeping the pancreas, but the team there was just great and really wanted to work with me, she said. The care team was just amazing. We loaded me up on blood thinners, and at one point I had 9 tubes in me to help drain the pooled blood and other fluids. The recovery was really hard, but I think recoveries from transplants are always hard, but they are also very successful. Ordorico said 97% to 98% of pancreas transplant patients are off insulin for a year, and 90% stay off insulin for 5 years. Nelson has been diabetes-free since the transplant. Melissa was very grateful and very communicative, Orderico said. She stood out as a patient because of the challenges she faced in her recovery. She was so positive, and her attitude was, "We'll get through this hand in hand." Melissa was very determined and very focused, and I know she is just as determined to talk about the importance of being an organ donor. As of September the 9th of 2022, 1 million organ transplants have been performed in the United States. For some perspective, in 1988, the Organ Procurement and Transplantation Network started the systematic collection of national donor and transplants data. Since that time, there have been 907,000 transplants. Between December of 1954, the date the first long-term kidney transplant, and December 1987, there were 93,000 transplants in the U.S. In 2021, transplants numbered more than 40,000 in the U.S. for the first time in history. A year later, there were 42,887. Being an organ donor is a chance to let your legacy live on, and it's a chance to give someone else time, Nelson said. It's not just time for the person getting the organ. That's time for family and loved ones and friends. It's the most valuable thing and chance to stay with the people who love you. Nelson cherishes the time and quality of life her transplant gave her, but she knew about the value of organ donation before her own transplant. Her father, Ward Larson, received a liver in 2014. "My dad got to live another 7 years," Nelson said. "He got to see the birth of Benjamin, my son, and a chance to be his grandpa. We got a chance to be with him and spend time with him. I remember his organ donor and my organ donor every single day. We are so grateful." Iowa residents can sign up to become organ donors at https://www.iowadonornetwork.org/register. Iowans can also declare their decision to donate organs when you renew your driver's license. Illinois residents can sign up to become organ donors at https://www.illinois.gov/services/service.organ-donor.html. They also can register as a donor by calling 1-800-210-2106 or by visiting a Secretary of State facility. Carol?
Thank you, Scott. Thankful for helping hands. This is an article by Tom Louie. Ashley Taylor smiled and offered gentle orders to a small army as she carried two trays laden with chicken, mashed potatoes, and several bowls of salad. Taylor is the single mother of three sons and one daughter. She led the kids to a spot at a table for Wednesday's noon meal at King's Harvest Shelter in Davenport. "The holidays are never an easy time," Taylor said, so she was thankful for the helping hand she got this year. Taylor and her children were just a few of the hundreds of people across the Quad Cities who received help at area shelters and agencies over Christmas weekend. "I do my best. I really do. And I appreciate the things that people do to help us. Someday I'm going to be able to give back," Taylor said. Taylor and her children were five of the roughly 70 people who showed up for the first meal at King's Harvest after Christmas. "We had right at 80 people on Friday, December 22nd, and we were right at about 100 on Saturday, December 23rd, said Lena Pillars, the assistant director at King's Harvest. Pillars and her crew offered backpacks and pillows as gifts for those who attended the Christmas meals. She said the shelter is starting to field an increasing number of calls from people looking for a place to live. Pillars said, "It's been a mild winter, and that allows some people to stay out longer. But this last month, we started to get calls from people living in their cars, people who have been evicted from their homes." King's Harvest has 11 low-cost apartments for those in need, Pillars said. She filled the last available apartment in the week before Christmas. Christian Care in Rock Island said 33 of its 42 available beds are filled, with people calling daily for space. The shelter expects more beds to fill as it gets colder. Humility Homes housed 90 people in its emergency shelter over Christmas weekend. For the past 4 years, Humility has reconfigured its lower-level space at 1016 West 5th Street from December 1st to April 15th to increase its number of emergency shelter beds from 88 to 124 to handle a seasonal influx of people seeking shelter from the elements. The shelter had been uncertain earlier in the fall if it would be able to offer the additional beds, citing a lack of funds. However, it received around $230,000 from local cities and counties, including Moline, Rock Island, Davenport, Bettendorf, Scott County, and Rock Island County, along with various partners. The additional funds mean Humility is able to offer the additional beds this year. Humility Homes Executive Director Ashley Velez said this year was the last of the agency's five-year plan to have emergency winter housing in place. The goal all along, she said, has been to reduce the need for expanded capacity in the winter by ramping up more permanent affordable housing stock. Humility Homes efforts during Christmas and throughout the year don't end with emergency beds. Velez said, we helped over 170 children who are in our programming celebrate the holidays. The holiday giving program wouldn't be possible this year without the support of Kunis Automotive Group providing $2,000 in sponsorship. We also rely on individual donors and groups to adopt the kids with gifts. Groups that assisted this year, just to name a few, were Heinz, St. Ambrose University, Dutrack Credit Union, and Brad Fugate with Modern Woodman. Humility Homes also used donations from its board of directors, various church partnerships, and Quick Star gas stations to provide over 250 gift cards to adults in its programming, including those living in affordable rental units. Velez said on any given night, 315 individuals are helped through Humility Homes' various programs. Taylor said she and her children are helped by Humility Homes every day. I wouldn't be homeless if it wasn't for Humility Homes' rapid housing program, Taylor said. There are times when we have really struggled, but the people at Humility are really good to us. Humility helped provide some Christmas presents for the kids, too. I come to the dinners because sometimes it's a struggle to put a holiday dinner together for four kids. And a lot of times I come here to be a positive person here for others. My kids and I, we have seen people here who are all alone. I have seen people break down and cry. The holidays can be a sad time. So I am here to share whatever I can. Scott?
Our next article is entitled Grabbing Opportunities. And the Quad City Times has been running a series of sitting down and speaking with college students from the area. And this is the sixth in that series. And it's about Miranda Hickey, who found support and took chances at EICC. Let's see. Miranda Hickey was among the graduates at Eastern Iowa Community College this fall, but doing so required a heavy load. On top of four online classes, the 23-year-old Clinton native worked full-time as a paraeducator at Whittier Elementary School in Clinton. Trying to balance the final classes I needed for my degree with work was a challenge, she said. And you know, I tend to take work home with me. Hickey was busy outside of these two sectors, too. This fall, she was also one of the students featured in EICC's episode on the College Tour series, soon streaming on Amazon Prime. Luckily, though, Hickey was sure to stay on top of things. I was actually able to finish one of my classes early thanks to it being online, she said. Sometimes you're able to work ahead. This kind of flexibility, Hickey added, was her favorite feature about EICC. Just because it allows people, especially non-traditional students who work or have families, to take classes at your own pace, she said, depending on how busy your schedule is. Still, Hickey knows online learning isn't for everyone. Some people, like me, have more motivation to get their work done via online learning, and others are like, oh, I have plenty of time, and then procrastinate because no one's harping on you to get everything turned in, she said. It's all on you. For those who must take the online route, Hickey offers the following advice. Definitely look ahead at due dates for your assignments, she said, explaining how she'd use that to plan ahead, scheduling a certain number of hours per week for each class. Also make sure I'm finding time to do my hobbies as well. Relaxing, for Hickey, usually involves video gaming or grabbing a cup of coffee. Even if I'm just picking the coffee up after work, Hickey said, it's just a time to treat myself. Amidst her constant shift between learning and educating, it helps to have a supportive work environment. They all want me to become a teacher, Hickey said. So it was very good to have someone I could talk to if I was feeling stressed or overworked instead of just keeping it to myself. I didn't have to buy my own computer, so that was awesome, Hickey said. Obviously, I still have to get good grades, and I had to work for the school district for 3 years after graduation. That's kind of like the deal. Noting continued teacher shortages, though, she's happy to do so. That's a big reason why I got that grant to go to school, Hickey said. EICC has been super helpful along the way and has opened the door to many new opportunities like the TV show. Joining Pi Theta Kappa, the International College Honor Society, and being a student marshal for commencement last May are other examples she cites. Even though it's a small community college, Hickey said, taking those little steps can get you so far in your educational journey. Hickey, a first-generation college student, attended EICC thanks to Iowa's Teacher and Paraeducator Registered Apprenticeship Grant Program. Earning the opportunity was a catalyst for a significant lesson for her. Take chances, Hickey said. When opportunities are given to you, you need to grab them, even if it's something you're scared or nervous or don't know anything about. In fact, she said, getting a degree wasn't always in the cards. I didn't even think I would go to college, Hickey said. My parents didn't even graduate high school, so this is all new. As both a K-12 educator and a recent college student, she sees a need for more two-way communication and kindness in education. There needs to be more communication between teachers, professors, and students, and just more kindness in general, Hickey said, especially since the pandemic, she added. In general, we just all have a lot going on mentally, maybe physically, in our homes, Hickey said to this point. I think that just needs to be communicated and dealt with better in the classroom. Another key issue for Hickey, perhaps unsurprisingly, is gun violence, specifically in schools. As an educator, you know, you want to be able to feel safe, she said. I think schools need to take the precautions to make everyone feel safe, and I think there needs to be more gun safety laws. In 2023, school shootings in the United States surpassed 2022's record-breaking total of 305, moving this margin for a third consecutive year. Now, touting an associate's degree, Hickey will finish the school year off at Eagle Heights Elementary School working as a substitute teacher. Her own learning, however, will continue online. I'm going to William Penn University, Hickey said. I'm joining their elementary education program, and I'm going to minor in special education.
Wars cast shadow over New Year's celebrations. Revelers counted down to midnight on New Year's Eve across the Middle East, Africa, and Europe, where firework and festive lights offered a hopeful start to 2024 for some, even as the globe's ongoing conflicts have subdued celebrations and raised security concerns. In Australia, more than 1 million people watched a pyrotechnic display centered on Sydney's famous Opera House and Harbour Bridge, a number of spectators equivalent to 1 in 5 of the city's residents. It's total madness, said German tourist Jana Thomas, who waited in the line since 7:30 a.m. to secure a prime waterfront location. Some 90,000 police and security officers were deployed around France, including Champs-Élysées Avenue, where large crowds took in a multidimensional light show projected onto the Arc de Triomphe, showcasing the history of Paris and sports on the menu for next year's Summer Olympics in the city. Police also lined up early in New York City to nab a spot in Times Square for the midnight ball drop. Officials and party organizers said they were prepared to keep tens of thousands of revelers safe in the heart of Manhattan, as the city has seen near daily protests sparked by the Israel-Hamas war. Fireworks light up the night. Stunning fireworks displays bloomed at iconic locations like the Acropolis in Athens, Greece, the sleek glass walls of the world's tallest building, the Burj Khalifa in the United Arab Emirates, and accompanied a collective cheer filling the air in Nairobi, Kenya. China celebrated Reveille relatively quietly, with most major cities banning fireworks over safety and pollution concerns. Still, people gathered and performers danced in colorful costumes in Beijing, while a crowd released wish balloons in Chongqing. During his New Year's address, Chinese President Xi Jinping said the country would focus on building momentum for economic recovery in 2024 and pledged China would surely be reunified with Taiwan. In Taipei, Taiwan's capital, the mood appeared upbeat as revelers gathered for a fireworks show at the bamboo-shaped Taipei 101 skyscraper, as well as at concerts and other events held throughout the city. From India, thousands of revelers from the financial hub of Mumbai watched the sun set over the Arabian Sea. In New Delhi, fireworks raised concerns that the capital, already infamous for its poor air quality, would be blanketed by a toxic haze on the first morning of the new year. Across Japan, people gathered at temples such as the Tsutsuki Temple in Tokyo, where visitors were given free hot milk and corn soup as they stood in line to strike a massive bell. At the Vatican, Pope Francis recalled 2023 as a year marked by wartime suffering. During his traditional Sunday blessing from a window overlooking St. Peter's Square, he offered prayers for the tormented Ukrainian people and the Palestinian and Israeli populations, the Sudanese people, and many others. At the end of the year, we will have the courage to ask ourselves how many human lives have been shattered by armed conflict, how many dead, and how much destruction, how much suffering, how much poverty, the pontiff said. In Russia, the country's military actions in Ukraine have overshadowed end-of-the-year celebrations, with the usual fireworks and concert on Moscow's Red Square canceled, as they were last year. Even without the festivities, people gathered in the square, and some cheered and pointed their phones at a clock counting down the year's final seconds. After shelling in the Russian border city of Belgorod on Saturday, which killed 24 people, some local authorities across Russia also canceled their usual firework displays, including in Vladivostok. Millions were expected to tune in to Russia President Vladimir Putin's New Year pre-recorded address, where Russians and stop the country's development. Israeli strikes in the Gaza Strip killed at least 35 on Sunday, hospital officials said, as the fighting raged across the tiny enclave a day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the war will continue for many more months, resisting international calls for a ceasefire. Scott?
Thank you, Carol. A reminder that you are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Normally at this time we would read the obituaries, but there are no obituaries in today's Quad City Times. There was also no opinions in today's Quad City Times, but I'm going to go ahead and read it and some opinions from yesterday's Quad City Times. And I'll start with the editorial. and it's entitled Davenport City Transparency Tops List of Wishes for 2024. The city government of Davenport tops our list of wishes for 2024. The city of Davenport needs a new, transparent approach to governing the city. When the downtown apartment building, the Davenport, partially collapsed May 28th, killing 3 people, causing an amputation and destroying the homes and belongings of residents, the public wanted to know why people were still living in a building. This newspaper joined the chorus of those asking how the city's system of inspections and oversight failed to safeguard these residents. We do appreciate that the city hired 2 firms to investigate the cause of the collapse. That report found that several years of improper repairs and lack of maintenance compromised the west wall's integrity, and that efforts to repair it in late May without proper shoring led to the collapse. The report, however, did not look at the city's processes and performance with regard to the building. And then came the separation agreements between the city and 3 members of the administration, including City Administrator Corey Spiegel. The agreements, in the amounts of $1.6 million, $157,000, and $140,500, were signed well before the November 7th election. Yet the public went to the polls without that information. They shouldn't have. And we don't know who was driving these timing decisions. Was it Spiegel, City Attorney Tom Warner, who will leave the city through retirement on Tuesday, or officials who were up for re-election? People deserve to know, and they deserve to know why sexual harassment that allegedly went on for years was not addressed. The council did finally approve the separation agreements in open session, as we argue is requested by law. That is a step in the right direction. We urge city leaders to address questions raised from the building collapse and the separation agreements in 2024. Start a new era of openness. Here are some other wishes for 2024. Improvements to downtown Rock Island. We hope the special service area tax, established in December of 2022, will begin to deliver improvements in downtown Rock Island. The tax for businesses in the service area is expected to deliver $315,000 per year for revitalization. Improvement to sidewalks, streets, and lighting will make the area more inviting for events such as farmers markets and festivals. A more vibrant Rock Island downtown is good for all of the Quad Cities. Continue with flood protection efforts in Davenport. We're happy to see further progress on the City of Davenport's 10-year, $165 million plan to protect 9 miles of riverfront from flooding. After the Mississippi River flood of 2019 caused $30 million in lost revenue and damages, the city developed a plan that it has now begun implementing. The next steps include an ARPA-funded $3.9 million project on River Drive from Kearney Avenue to East 3rd Street, and a $1.4 million project at the intersection of West River Drive and Marquette Street that will include installing gate well structures and improve the underground storm sewer structures. The project is expected to keep East River Drive open up to a 22-foot flood stage. Flood protection is vital to the businesses and traffic along the Mississippi River. Pull full speed ahead with the project. And wish Moline success with riverfront development. One of Moline's ongoing projects is to make better use of the riverfront land near the old I-74 bridge. In 2022, the city bought the former K. Cone building and the 7 acres of land around it for $3.1 million. The city has not yet decided what to do with the building. Demolition would cost about $2 million, but it is proposing a skate park and pump track, a track for bicycling, on the land. We'd like to see continued development of this area to turn it into a destination. Other wishes for the Quad Cities in 2024 include expanding the successful gun violence intervention program to other communities in the Quad Cities. This different approach has reduced gun crimes in Davenport and is worth trying elsewhere. a wish for the drought to end and restore moisture to farmland and return rivers to normal levels. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources says we are in the longest drought since the 1950s. And we wish Bettendorf well in its pursuit of Phase 2 developments at the TBK Bank Sports and Entertainment Complex. Planned on 100 acres east of Middle Road are a 58-bay golf range, another multi-sport building, a Marriott, an orthopedics building, along with multiple shops and restaurants. Nearly 40 businesses have already sprung up at the complex. We're excited to see more to come. Happy New Year, Quad Cities.
Well, and this article is not really an opinion, but Wonka ends the year number one at the box office. Hollywood closed out an up-and-down 2023 with Wonka regaining number one at the box office. Strong sales for The Color Purple and an overall $9 billion in ticket sales that improved on 2022's grosses, but fell about $2 billion shy of pre-pandemic norms. The New Year's weekend box office this year lacked a true blockbuster. This time last year, Avatar: The Way of Water was inundating theaters. Instead, a wide array of films, among them Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, The Boys in the Boat, Migration, Ferrari, The Iron Claw, and Anyone But You, sought to break out over the year's most lucrative box office quarter. The top choice, though, remained Wonka. Paul King's musical starring Timothy Chalamet as a young Willy Wonka. In its third weekend, the Warner Brothers release collected an estimated $24 million Friday through Sunday and $31.8 million factoring in estimates for the Monday holiday. That brings the film's domestical total to $142.5 million. That bested Warner Brothers' own Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, which, like previous DC superhero films, is struggling. James Wan's Aquaman sequel, starring Jason Momoa, took in $19.5 million in its second weekend, to bring its two-week haul to a modest $24.7 million, including New Year's Day estimates. The original Aquaman, which ultimately surpassed $1.1 billion worldwide, had grossed $215.4 million over a similar period in 2018, more than double that of the sequel. Internationally, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom added $50.5 million. Weekend sales only tell part of the story this time of year. From Christmas through New Year's, when kids are out of school and many adults are not working, every day is like Saturday to film distributors. The Color Purple, Blitz Bazalke's adaptation of the 2005 stage musical from Alice Walker's novel, debuted on Monday and led all movies on Christmas with $18 million. Through the week, the Warner Brothers release has grossed $50 million, including $13 million Friday through Sunday. That's a strong start for the crowd pleaser, starring Fantasia Barrino, Taraji P. Henson, and Danielle Brooks. Audiences gave it an A cinema score. Scott?
From the Nation and World page, A3 of the Quad City Times, Chief Justice wary of artificial intelligence. Roberts's annual report makes no mention of ethics Trump cases. This is written by Mark Sherman of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. Chief Justice John Roberts on Sunday turned his focus to the promise and shortcomings of artificial intelligence in the federal courts in an annual report that made no mention of Supreme Court ethics or legal controversies involving Donald Trump. Describing artificial intelligence as the latest technological frontier, Roberts discussed the pros and cons of computer-generated content in his legal profession. His remarks come just a few days after the latest instance of AI-generated fake legal citations making their way into official court records in a case involving ex-Trump lawyer Michael Cohen. Always a bad idea, Roberts wrote in his year-end report, noting that any use of AI requires caution and humility. At the same time, though, the Chief Justice acknowledged that AI can make it much easier for people without much money to access the courts. Quote, these tools have the welcome potential to smooth out any mismatch between available resources and urgent needs in our court system, end quote, Roberts wrote. The report came at the end of a year in which a series of stories questioned the ethical practices of the justices, and the court responded to critics by adopting its first code of conduct. Many of those stories focused on Justice Clarence Thomas and his failure to disclose travel, other hospitality, and additional financial ties with wealthy conservative donors, including Harlan Crowe and the Koch brothers. But Justices Samuel Alito and Sonia Sotomayor also have been under scrutiny. The country also is entering the beginning of an election year that seems likely to enmesh the court in some way in the ongoing criminal case against Donald Trump and efforts to keep the Republican former president off the 2024 ballot. Along with his eight colleagues, Roberts almost never discusses cases that are before the Supreme Court or seem likely to get there. In past reports, he has advocated for enhanced security and salary increases for federal judges, praised judges and their aides for dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, and highlighted other aspects of technological changes in the courts. Roberts once famously compared judges to umpires who call balls and strikes but don't make the rules. In his latest report, he turned to a different sport, tennis, to make the point that technology won't soon replace judges. At many tennis tournaments, optical technology rather than human line judges now determines whether 130-mile-per-hour serves are in or out. These decisions involve precision to the millimeter, and there is no discretion. The ball either did or did not hit the line. By contrast, legal determinations often involve gray areas that still require application of human judgment, Roberts wrote.
And doesn't look like there's a lot of sports. I think I'll read another article from the Nation and the World. New gun law takes effect in California. The measure bans people from carrying firearms in most public places. A California law that bans people from carrying firearms in most public places will take effect New Year's Day, even as a court case continues to challenge the law. A U.S. district judge issued a ruling December 20th to block the law from taking effect, saying it violates the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and deprives people of their ability to defend themselves and their loved ones. But on Saturday, a federal appeals court put a temporary hold on the district judge's ruling. The appeals court decision allows the law to go into effect as the legal fight continues. Attorneys are scheduled to file arguments to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in January and in February. The law, signed by Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom, prohibits people from carrying concealed guns in 26 places, including public parks and playgrounds, churches, banks, and zoos. The ban applies regardless of whether the person has a permit to carry a concealed weapon. One exception is for privately owned businesses that put up signs saying people are allowed to bring guns on their premises. This ruling will allow our common sense gun laws to remain in place while we appeal the district court's dangerous ruling, Newsom posted to X, formerly Twitter, after the appeals court acted Saturday. Californians overwhelmingly support efforts to ensure that places like hospitals, libraries, and children's playgrounds remain safe and free from guns. Station sued to block the law when U.S. District Judge Cormac Carney granted a preliminary injunction blocking the law. He wrote that law was sweeping, repugnant to the Second Amendment, and openly defiant of the Supreme Court. Carney wrote that gun rights groups are likely to succeed in proving it unconstitutional, meaning that it would be permanently overturned. The law overhauls California's rules for concealed carry permits in light of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in New York State's Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, which set several states scrambling to react with their own laws. The decision said the constitutionality of gun laws must be assessed by whether they are quote, consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation, unquote. Newsom has said he will keep pushing for stricter gun measures. Newsom has positioned himself as a national leader on gun control, while he is being increasingly eyed as a potential presidential candidate. He has called for and signed a variety of bills, including measures targeting untraceable ghost guns, the marketing of firearms to children, and allowing people to bring lawsuits over gun violence. That legislation was patterned on a Texas anti-abortion law. California Attorney General Rob Bonta appealed Carney's decision. Bonta, a Democrat, said that if the district judge's ruling to block the law were allowed to stand, it would endanger communities by allowing guns in places where families and children gather. Scott?
Thanks, Carol. Here's what's on TV today in the sports world. At 11 a.m., college basketball taking place on CBS Sports Network, Hampton at Drexel. And, of course, college football is happening today at 11 a.m. on ESPN2. It's the ReliaQuest Bowl, Wisconsin versus LSU from Tampa, Florida. That game can also be seen on the SEC Network. And at noon on ABC, it's the Citrus Bowl, the Iowa Hawkeyes versus Tennessee, which takes place in Orlando, Florida. Also at noon on ESPN and ESPNU, you can catch the VRBO Fiesta Bowl, Liberty versus Oregon from Glendale, Arizona. At 5 p.m., it's the college football playoff semifinal, the Rose Bowl, Alabama versus Michigan from Pasadena, California. You can see that on ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPNU, and the SEC Network. All those channels are showing the Rose Bowl. And then at 8:45 p.m. on the same channels, you can see the college football playoff semifinal, the All-State Sugar Bowl, which features Texas and Washington from New Orleans. So again, that's on ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, and ESPNU. NBA basketball, 2 p.m. on NBA TV is Minnesota at New York. And in the NHL at 3 p.m., it's the Winter Classic. Excuse me, that's at 2 p.m. It's the Winter Classic, Vegas versus Seattle. That's on TNT and on True TV. And here's a rundown of NFL scores from yesterday. The Ravens defeated Miami 56-19. The Chiefs beat the Bengals 25-17. The Bills beat the Patriots 27-21. Cardinals 35, Eagles 31. The 49ers 27, Commanders 10. Los Angeles Rams 26, New York Giants 25. Jaguars 26, Panthers 0. Colts defeated the Raiders 23-20. Texas 26, Titans 3. The Saints over the Buccaneers 23-13. Chicago Bears defeated the Atlanta Falcons 37-17. Pittsburgh Steelers 30, Seattle Seahawks 23, Denver Broncos 16, Chargers 9. And the Green Bay Packers outlasted the Minnesota Vikings last night 33-10. And in men's college basketball, Stanford pulls a stunner, rolls by number 4 Arizona. Freshman guard Kanan Carlisle scored 25 points. Spencer Jones added 21 points on 8-for-9 shooting. And Stanford surprised number 4 Arizona 100-82 in a Pac-12 matchup on Sunday. Andre Stojakovic scored 16 points, and center Maxime Reynau had 12 points and 7 rebounds for the Cardinal. Caleb Love led Arizona with 23 points, and center Omar Balo added 12 and 7 rebounds. The victory was Stanford's first over a ranked opponent since beating Arizona last season and its 8th over a ranked team since 2020. Number 12, Oklahoma, 72, Monmouth, 56. Jalen Moore scored 21 points, and the Sooners concluded their non-conference schedule with the home victory. Otega Owen scored 13 points, and Javian McCollum added 11 for Oklahoma. And number 24, Mississippi, 95, Bryant, 78. Allen Flanagan scored 20 points, Matthew Morrell had 18, and the duo combined for 31 second-half points as the Rebels matched the 2007-2008 team for the best start in program history at 11-0.
And for some of you who follow racing, Carl Yarborough passed away. Toughness defined three-time NASCAR champion. Carl Yarborough, considered one of NASCAR's all-time greatest drivers and the first to win three consecutive cup titles, died on Sunday. He was 84. NASCAR announced the death of the Hall of Famer and South Carolina native in a statement. No cause was given. Cale Yarborough was one of the toughest competitors NASCAR has ever seen. His combination of talent, grit, and determination separated Cale from his peers, both on the track and in the record book, said Jim France, chairman and CEO of NASCAR. He was respected and admired by competitors and fans alike and was as comfortable behind the wheel of a tractor as he was behind the wheel of a stock car. Known for his fierce toughness and grit, Yarborough won the Daytona 500 four times and the Southern 500 at his home track of Darlington Raceway five times. His 83 Cup Series victories are tied with Jimmy Johnson for sixth on NASCAR's all-time win list, and Yarborough ranks fourth with 69 pole positions. But one of his most famous moments came in the 1979 Daytona 500, the first to be televised live, flag to flag across the country. Yarborough, a Golden Gloves boxer who also earned a football scholarship to Clemson, crashed while racing with Donnie Allison on the final lap for the win. The two drivers got out of their wrecked cars to fight. Allison's brother Bobby pulled over to join the scrap, and it was two Allison brothers versus Yarborough as Richard Petty crossed the finish line first. It was a breakthrough moment for NASCAR, which, because of a snowstorm on the East Coast, was being shown on live TV to its largest audience ever. Yarborough quit full-time racing after winning six races in 1980 and finishing second in the Cup standings after winning three straight crowns from 1976 to 78. He said at the time it was to spend more time with his three daughters. I sure hoped I was going to get to this point because working in the back of the fields in that hot sun would make you want to do something else, he said. Scott.
Thanks, Carol. In NBA news, Williamson Ingram spark Pelicans past slumping Lakers. Zion Williamson and Brandon Ingram each scored 26 points, and the New Orleans Pelicans beat the road-weary Los Angeles Lakers 129-109 Sunday night. Los Angeles was coming off a 108-106 loss at Minnesota on Saturday night, while New Orleans was off 2 days after beating Utah at home Thursday night. LeBron James scored 34 points, and former Pelican Anthony Davis added 20 points and 10 rebounds, but they didn't get enough help as the Lakers lost for the seventh time in 9 games. C.J. McCollum added 22 points for the Pelicans, who led by 19 and responded to each comeback bid with the help of 50% three-point shooting as a team and a crafty 6-foot guard, Jose Grand Theft Alvarado's 4 steals and 2 blocks. The Hawks 130, the Wizards 126. Trae Young had 40 points and 13 assists. DeJounte Murray had 32 points, and Atlanta overcame a slow start and spotty late foul shooting to win at Washington. Jalen Johnson scored a career-high 24 points and had 13 rebounds on a day when four Hawks finished with double-doubles to help their team remain unbeaten against the Wizards this season. Other NBA scores, the Celtics defeated the Spurs 134-101. The Thunder defeated the Nets 124-108. Suns 112, Magic 107. And the Kings downed the Grizzlies 123-92. In NHL, Frederick scores twice to lead Bruins. Trent Frederick scored twice. Charlie Coyle had the go-ahead goal, and the Boston Bruins beat the Detroit Red Wings on Sunday 5-3. Boston forward Pavel Zacha scored an empty net goal in his 500th regular season game. Jake DeBrusick also added an empty netter, and Charlie McAvoy had two assists for the Bruins, who have won three straight. Jeremy Swayman made 25 saves. Jake Walman scored his third goal in two games for Detroit. Ben Chiarot and JT Compher had the Red Wings' other goals. Other NHL scores, the Jets 3, the Wilds 2. Senators defeated the Sabres 5-1. Penguins 3, Islanders 1. Lightning 4, Canadiens 3. The Oilers defeated the Ducks 7-2. Flames 4, Flyers 3. Avalanche 3, Sharks 1, and the Stars beat the Blackhawks 8-1. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Scott Splavik, and your partner and my partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockard. You can listen to Iowa's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.